are listening to the True Frequency Radio Network.
No hate, no hype, no fear.
Hello, hello, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys for tuning in today. We are live right now. My name is JD, and this is, of course, your daily dose of deprogramming. Today is the 16th day of December, and it is Tuesday. We once again got another Monday in the books, so I'm really excited about that. Thank you guys all for joining us once again here on the program today. We have got a huge, huge, huge show for you guys today. Oh my goodness, ladies and gentlemen, 11 o'clock, L.A. Marzulli is going to be on the program. Now, I haven't spoken with L.A. in almost a year. The last time I spoke with L.A., the seventh DVD in his Watchers series had just come out, and he was anticipating another trip back down to Peru to look at some more artifacts down there. And if you guys are unfamiliar with L.A. Marzulli, he's essentially Indiana Jones. I don't know how else to put it, but that's essentially who this gentleman is. He is probably one of the most world-renowned researchers when it comes to ufology, ancient megalithic structures. He's really big into physical evidence, elongated skulls and things like that. So a lot, I'm sure, has happened in the last year. There is a new Watchers episode out now, number 8, The Cloak of Secrecy. So we're going to talk to him about all of the discoveries and all of the things that he has discovered in the last year. So I am humbled, ladies and gentlemen, to be joining or to be welcoming L.A. Marzulli to the program at the 11 o'clock hour. So please do stay tuned for that. There's a lot of news to go over today as well. Many of you out there have been doing awesome at checking out the website every day. Can't appreciate you guys enough, those of you guys who are checking out the site. And as usual, every day there is a show section where you can learn more about the guest that we're going to have on, and also talk about the talk about some of the news articles that are happening in the news. Tons and tons of stuff going on today. So if you go to that news link, or the show link, excuse me, at redpillreports.com, you can get into all of these articles that we're going to try and go over. Give you a heads up, the rest of the week is going to be amazing in terms of guests. We've got Scott Bennett on tomorrow. Scott Bennett is the second part of Greg Morse's incredible research team that is working so hard to break this mortgage crisis scandal. And again, you know, we're coming up on the holiday season right now, so it's a perfect opportunity for you guys to get your friends and families in the loop on what is going on with this mortgage scandal. This is just crazy what's going on with this. So if you go again, redpillreports.com, right there at the top, there's a section called Featured, and there is a little link there in red called Mortgage Crisis. It will take you to all of the articles. I highly recommend everybody print them out. There's also a link to Greg Morse's petition. Man, I would like to see this petition get filled up so we could get these congressional hearings underway and start doing something about this issue. And it takes all of us doing something. And this is it. This is what you guys can do. Sign that petition. Get that petition in front of other people that think that they own their homes and most likely do not. Anyway, Scott Bennett will be joining us at 11 o'clock tomorrow. So that will be an amazing discussion as well. We've got Elsie Vincent and Andrew Gauss on later in the week. So it's going to be an amazing week, and I cannot appreciate all of you guys enough for tuning in. I hope all of you went to truthfrequencyradio.com yesterday and entered Bluebeam into the search window and played around with the little rocket ship that shows up so you can blow up the site. Because I had so much fun doing that yesterday, I almost had to cancel the show. I thought, man, I'm just going to sit here for 2 hours and blow this website over and over. Anyway, I'll get off of all the goofiness right now. I just want to thank you guys again for being here every day. Really important that we all team up and try and figure out exactly what is going on in the world, because the agenda is thick and it doesn't seem to be getting any less thick as we move forward here. There seems to be just, you know, we're just on this trajectory right now towards a complete global either financial meltdown or some sort of actual armed conflict with Russia. I can see it coming. We saw oil prices continue to fall yesterday. We'll get into some economic news, but I'll tell you what, right now, ladies and gentlemen, Russia is really hurting. Despite what you might hear on the mainstream media or some of the reports coming from RT, Russia right now, the ruble has fallen from 45 rubles to the dollar, which was just last week, all the way to 100 rubles for a dollar. That's just a very, very significant loss. And they did some pretty major moves that we'll talk about when we get into economic stuff here in a little bit. They did some pretty major economic moves yesterday and hoped that they could stymie the fall of the ruble against the dollar. And so far this morning, it looks like they have been unsuccessful. So I know for a fact that they are calling an emergency financial meeting in Moscow this morning. If that news breaks while we are on the show, I will come in and I'll let you know what's going on with that. But let's jump into some international news before we get into the economic stuff. So, of course, you know, today, as I mentioned, was December 16th. Today is Tuesday, and these are your Red Pill Reports for Tuesday, the 16th of December. The big story coming out of international news, obviously, if you're paying attention, was the Sydney hostage situation. The Sydney hostage situation was a 17-hour ordeal in its entirety, and ended yesterday morning in Sydney local time after a shot was fired inside the building and the police stormed the cafe. It turns out that the hostage taker was one man. He was an Iranian refugee with a fairly extensive criminal past. His name is Haron Moniz, and he had been holding several people hostage, but that situation did come to an end yesterday. Again, let's see here. A police source named the man again. His name was Haron Moniz, and this is, of course, according to the police report coming out of Sydney yesterday. According to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Moniz is an Iranian cleric and a refugee who was granted asylum in Australia. ABC reported that Moniz faces over 40 sexual and indecent assault charges. And according to Reuters, Moniz was convicted in 2012 for offensive and threatening letters to families of 8 Australian soldiers killed in Afghanistan. He's also been identified in the past as a spiritual healer, according to him. His lawyer, Mandy Condidas, said that his ideology is just so strong and powerful that it clouds his vision for common sense and objectiveness. So his ideology is so strong that he, for some reason, committed or is at least facing charges for 40 acts of sexual indecent assault charges. So how clouded, really? I mean, wow. Anyway, his attorney goes on to say he was also charged last year as an accessory to the murder of his ex-wife, who was stabbed multiple times and set on fire in Western Sydney. So clearly the gentleman has got a little bit of cognitive dissonance going on, really not functioning on all cylinders at this point. And apparently, he was shot and killed in a nighttime rescue operation, and two hostages apparently were also killed in the gunfire. But there's a fantastic activist post article also featured in the Red Pill Reports news under today's show links there, and it's done by Brandon Tuberville, who I've had the pleasure to speak with. He's a writer over at Activist Post, very, very smart young man. But he's talking about, in this article, 5 different reasons to question the official story of the Sydney siege. We haven't really heard too much about the Sydney siege yet in terms of what the spin is going to be from the mainstream media. But I did see a couple of reports, essentially. You know, the initial indications were that he was an ISIS member. He had a flag that was held up. You know, he had some hostages hold a flag up in the window there. And, but the problem is, according to Brandon Tuberville, is that he's really not part of the Islamic group. And even though the mainstream media in the United States most likely is going to jump on that bandwagon and say, you know, this is another indication of ISIS targeting Australia, which there have been a few instances. You know, Australia did a big roundup of extremists not too long ago, and since then have kind of been under the ire of ISIS. But the problem is that Moniz is a Shia, and he's not Sunni. And Sunni, of course, is the brand that Islam or that ISIS espouses in terms of Islam, and the two don't really intersect in terms of their fundamentalist beliefs. So most likely he was not carrying this out as some sort of political activism, or at least in terms of supporting ISIS, it does not look like at this point that's what he was doing. But we shall have to wait and see how the mainstream media and the media there in Australia spins this story. But interesting a little bit that we're going to jump on the ISIS bandwagon, and there's probably not a lot of indication yet that that's actually the case. We've got an interesting story coming out of Turkey right now, as just over the weekend, the government orchestrated crackdown on independent critical media outlets in Turkey took a turn for the worse over the weekend, with dawn raids on Turkey's largest newspaper, Zaman, and popular national TV show that led to the detention of top managers at all of these media outlets. A total of 31 people in Turkey have been arrested, mostly high-ranking media personnel, directors and producers of popular television series, and police officers were actually taken into custody also. The prosecutor in charge of the investigation said in a statement that the suspects were detained on charges of establishing, heading, or being member of a terrorist organization. Fraud and slander are also some of what the suspects are accused of, according to the prosecutor. The editor-in-chief of Turkey's best-selling daily newspaper, Zaman, said that, and the broadcasting group, Samanyula, their broadcasting group's general manager, have also been arrested. So the editor-in-chief of Zaman and also the Samanyula broadcasting group general manager also arrested. The Zaman Daily and the television station are among the media outlets which have been critical of the government for alleged corruption since two major graft probes went public in December of last year. The police operation came just ahead of the first anniversary of these graft probes, which was December 17th and the 25th of December last year. And among these several police officers who were detained are former heads, respectively, of the anti-terrorism unit of the Istanbul Police Department and the head of the Department of Organized Crime. So not just media, but also heads of state and heads of some pretty high echelon intelligence groups in the police department there coming under arrest this weekend. The operation came shortly after Parliament passed a law that enabled prosecutors to detain people based just on reasonable suspicion. And the prosecutor in charge of the investigation has issued a confidentiality order in the cases. Neither the lawyer nor the suspects are allowed to see the content of the investigation file. So that's probably not going to go well for the people who want to mount some sort of defense against these arrests if they can't see what it exactly they're being charged with. So you see this crackdown of independent media taking place all over the world. We had the story of the dry run coming from Mike Adams at Natural News the other day about the dry run going on in California as a bunch of alternative media sites were shut down there. Now we're seeing it happening in Turkey. I can't imagine what we'll see tomorrow, but I imagine it'll move in the same direction. Palestinians right now saying they will seek UN vote on resolution to end the Israeli occupation. They are asking for a resolution setting the November 2016 as a deadline for ending the Israeli occupation of Palestine. The announcement came late on Sunday after a meeting between Palestinian President Mohammed Abbas and officials from his Fatah movement and the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Officials say the Jordanian-backed resolution is to be submitted by tomorrow. Another proposal by France would set a time limit of 2 years for Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Israel obviously opposes the resolution, and the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting Israel and Palestinian leaders in Europe to find some sort of compromise. U.S. officials say they are not opposed to a new Security Council resolution, but that none of the drafts so far are acceptable. So still bad things going on in Palestine and Israel right now, unfortunately. But looks like the UN is getting closer and closer to some kind of involvement, so we shall see what happens there. And another report, this time coming out of Lebanon, but having to do with Israel, saying that Israel has been stealing from Lebanon's offshore oil and gas reserve for years. This is, of course, according to a member of the Lebanon's parliament in a spiel that he gave yesterday. He says the claim is very similar to charges made against the parliament speaker Berry earlier this year. The statement also noted that the Israeli regimes believe that it can lay claim to an area while the UN considers it to be a disputed zone between Lebanon and the Palestinian territories. What the UN position spells out is that all parties should refrain from drilling, exploring, or any other form of activity. So he further warned that the possibility of that the Tel Aviv regime is using horizontal drilling to access energy reserves that exclusively belong to Lebanon. So right now, the area is essentially under review by the UN, and so the PM for Lebanon is saying, well, while the area is under review, nothing is supposed to be going on. But for the last several years, while it's been under review, we have evidence now of some horizontal drilling that's been taking place, which means essentially Israel has been siphoning off gas from one of Lebanon's reserves in an area very close to the southern border with the Palestinian territories. So very interesting if that happens to be true. Not really sure, but that's certainly what Lebanon is saying right now. And in other related Hamas and Israeli news, the Gaza-ruling Hamas terrorist group led a military parade over the weekend in which thousands of jihadis marched through the streets celebrating the 27th anniversary of the Holy Warrior organization's founding, while calling for, of course, Israel's destruction and praising its client state, the Islamic Republic of Iran. In July, Hamas allegedly provoked a war with the state of Israel by constantly bombarding them with unprovoked and indiscriminate rocket fire. That, obviously, this story is coming from RT, and you can take that with a grain of salt which way you want to believe. But the war itself did result in the deaths of over 2,000 Palestinians and dozens of Israelis. This discrepancy in the death has been credited to Israelis' qualitative edge and its investment in defense systems to protect its citizens. Now, again, we could get into a discussion about whether you're pro-Israel or pro-Palestine or whether or not you think words written down on paper justify the murder of children and civilians. But it really doesn't matter because if any of you guys have been listening to me for a while, not just on this show but on others, I already solved this problem. I solved the Israeli-Gaza problem. And I'll talk with LA about this today. But here's the deal. You guys know about the Iron Dome, right? We know about the Iron Dome. The United States sends $8.5 million a day over to Israel so they can fund projects like the Iron Dome, which is ostensibly a large force field type shield that when it detects something coming in, it shoots a rocket or a missile to intercept whatever it is that's coming in. Okay, so the Iron Dome, here's what we do. Triple it. Make it three times as good. Make it so good that nothing in the possible world, not even meteorite, can get through this thing. Okay, do that. Then put one over Gaza, right? Same thing, just as strong. Put it over the West Bank, build that thing so that no thing could ever get in. No, not even a meteorite, right? And then flip the polarity so that nothing can get out from either place. Same thing. Flip the polarity, put a dome on them, don't let them shoot anything out. Take the key away. Tell them in 100 years, if they choose to get along with one another, we'll give them the keys back. And there you go. Problem solved. Technology solving problems, not legislating morality, because that doesn't work. Technologically solve the problem. Put a dome over them. Take the key away. Lock it up. Done. Okay, you're welcome. Thanks, guys. Anyway, Hamas, Israel, blah, blah, blah. Gonna be still bad for a while. We'll see what happens there. I'm not excited about it. Not gonna lie. Let's see here. Moving into this other goofy story coming out of Canada right now. I wanted to mention this. The new Canadian driver's license include an indicator on them to let authorities know if you are a user of medical marijuana. Yes, on your driver's license in Canada, it can be shown right now that your medical abstract, the records of your medical records, accessible now on your driver's abstract. Not only that, but there is now an indicator on your driver's license that you are a medical marijuana user. Why would they do that? And I'll tell you, I'm not a organ transplant, an organ donor. And if I was going to be an organ donor, I would put it in my will that I want my organs to be donated to friends and family or whatever. But I think when you put things on your driver's license, you somehow become a target. And it makes me wonder why your medical information in Canada would now be showing up on your driver's license. Because, again, in a world where that is considered a medicine, which is civilization, which I long for here in the United States, that's medical records. That has nothing to do with law enforcement, and it isn't anybody's business. That seems like a gross invasion of privacy, in my opinion. So anyway, if you're in Canada, heads up, don't renew your driver's license until they sort this issue out, because I would not want every law enforcement officer that pulled me over for a ticket to have some sort of indication that they need to search my car, which is obviously where that's going to go. So anyway, that's what's going on in your international news right now. Probably a lot more stuff. And there is obviously a lot more stuff, but a lot of it has to do with economic things. So we're going to go into some national news right now, try and get through some of the things that are going on right now. Former CIA Director Mike Morrell was on the television the other day. And don't ask me how I know that, because I don't watch TV, but someone sent me this link. And it was very surprising to me, because he was actually just talking about the current Sydney, Australia situation, which was obviously was yesterday. So we're talking about the siege. And he kind of dropped a little bit of a bombshell right on CBS Monday Morning News when he basically said that jihadist militants will likely carry out similar operations here in the United States. So again, you know, it can be debated now as to whether or not this guy in Sydney was a jihadist militant. You know, he's dead now, so we're not really going to be able to find out much about his motivation. But what's interesting about this story, just as we were saying, you know, Morrell goes on to say, you know, this hostage situation in Australia is not surprising because 300 Australians have left the country to go fight in Iraq and Syria, including 70 who are fighting for ISIS. So you see him there trying to tie that thread together. He also goes on to say ISIS has had a focus on Australia for some time, just like what we had talked about earlier, saying, you know, a couple of months ago, the Australians did a countrywide raid, arresting a number of people after senior ISIS leader called for individuals in Australia to behead Australians in public for ISIS. So now, of course, according to Morrell, the focus of ISIS has been on Australia. So you can see here that he not only wants to link this Iranian refugee, who, again, was not part of the ISIS organization because he does not fit the religious criteria that they would require for him to have. But they are going to tie this into ISIS. And now he goes on to say, you know, not only is it not surprising that we saw it in Australia, but it won't be surprising when we see it here. So there you go. Former CIA saying, keep your head on a swivel. Not really a great thing. Whew. How about a new story coming out? I think this is out of Spokane Valley, one of my favorite places in the world up in Washington State. Has been some footage that was provided exclusively to InfoWars. These guys do such a great job over there. But this footage shows a Washington State sheriff's deputy proclaiming that law enforcement officers need armored military vehicles because of constitutionalists with firearms. And he's very frank about it. So this footage, as I said, recently captured in Spokane Valley, begins with a local resident asking two deputies why in the world police would need vehicles specifically designed for warfare abroad. And he goes on to say, this is the deputy, he says, I mean, we got a lot of constitutionalists around here and a lot of people that stockpile weapons, lots of ammunition, one of the deputies says. He says, they have weapons here locally. Wow, so that's a pretty startling admission. It not only points to active surveillance of legal gun owners, but also of those who support the country's founding document, further solidifying concerns among law-abiding citizens that police are receiving military equipment and training in order to target conservative Americans. The deputy's specific mention of constitutionalists, which is a pretty broad term covering millions of Americans as opposed to criminals in general, also indicates clear training and mindsets linked to the FBI and Homeland Security, two groups who have been absurdly labeled as liberty lovers, as terrorist threats. You know, we're not terror threats, people. We like liberty. And again, liberty is universal. It is not the sole possession of Americans. So, man, these people are just crazy. Wow. very clear talking points, obviously being supported by the Southern Poverty Law Center, and just ridiculous. So, and there's this article goes on to outline a few other incidents. You know, the police sergeant in Indiana admitted last May that his department had obtained an MRAP because of their fear of returning military veterans, which were deemed at the time to be domestic terrorist threats by the Homeland Security. Of course, this was back in 2009. Another incident in August of 13 in Concord, New Hampshire, where the police chief, John Duvall, secretly contacted Homeland Security and demanded an armored vehicle due to the alleged threat posed by peaceful libertarians. A New York State counterterrorism bulletin leaked to InfoWars by concerned police in that same year attempted to label anyone concerned with government gun confiscation as far-right conspiracy theorists, even as admitting gun confiscation programs are used against law-abiding citizens in states like California. Obviously, we could also talk about the MIAC report, which was the federal training document famously presented to Missouri police back in 2009, going as far as to falsely trying supporters of President candidate Ron Paul and the constitutional, trying to marginalize them into quote unquote extremist groups. It just goes on and on and on. But interesting now that the sheriffs in my favorite state of Washington are being so candid about the fact that who they are concerned about are preppers, constitutionalists, the very people that they are supposedly taking an oath to protect, and the people who will probably be shoulder to shoulder with these guys on the front line if things were to go bad. Really, really clear that we are being drawn into a fight against our will. But that is what's going on there. We've got to move on to a quick 3-minute break. I obviously have some more national news to get to. We've got some health stories and some tech stuff to talk about also. It's going to be a really big day. I want to remind everybody to stay with us at 11 o'clock. L.A. Marzulli is going to be here, and we're going to have some pretty amazing things to talk about. So do be here for that. Stay with us through this 3-minute break. I'll be right back. This is your Red Pill Reports for the 16th day of December. Back in a flash.
So, you want the news and information without the hate, the hype, the fear? Well, you've come to the right place. You can support Truth Frequency Radio by spreading the word on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, or your favorite forums. Want to take Truth Frequency Radio on the road? Listen on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or other mobile devices. Want more than just the free stuff? Sign up for a VIP membership for as little as $4 a month and get super high-quality downloads, member-only content, and instant access to your favorite shows without the wait. It's only through your loving support that we're able to cover the cost and continue broadcasting. So now, stay tuned for more Free Speech Radio right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. KTFRN. Worldwide.
Here at MyPatriotSupply.com, our customers are number one. Built on a self-sustaining business model, we don't owe our existence to big banks or big business. Instead, the company was built by you, the customer. The success of My Patriot Supply is a testimony to the loyalty and dedication of each and every one of you, to our old-fashioned values and top-rated customer service. These elements alone have made us the number one choice of patriots everywhere. We believe that being prepared should not be a luxury reserved by people with large disposable incomes, which is why we have the products you need at the prices you can afford. We bring you our Patriot Pantry brand of storable food, which features top-of-the-line flavors and carefully packed to store for 25 years. Plus water purification systems, non-GMO heirloom seeds, survival gear, and much, much more. Visit MyPatriotSupply.com or call 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. MyPatriotSupply.com.
nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule 1 drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
Sound Doctrine Ministries with Kenneth Emanuel.
Sundays on True Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys for sticking with us through that 3-minute break. I wanted to remind everybody that there is a new chat room going on at truthfrequencyradio.com. If you go there and go into right at the top there where it says listen live, it will take you into a little chat room action. It is in beta testing right now, but if you want to shoot questions or suggestions over to myself, I will be here in the chat room, and also when L.A. Mizzouli joins us in the second hour, if you have any questions for him, it would be a great opportunity for you guys to put them in there, and then I will read them, and I will bring them over to the discussion. Nice, fantastic way for listeners and guests to connect. One of the best features that I have seen in live radio in a long, long time. One of my biggest wishes was to have an interactive chat with the audience, because obviously, you know, here at Red Pill, that's our whole goal, guys, is just to create a forum for everyone to join in the discussion. We're all here to learn, so anything that we can do to bring listeners and guests together, that's what we want to do. So please go to truthfrequencyradio.com and check out this new Listen Live chat room. This is exciting stuff, and I'm really happy that Chris was able to pull that all together for us. So again, I'll be in there. So if you have questions for LA in the next hour, that's where you're going to want to post them. Let's move on back into the national news right now. There is a startling story coming out of the California Highway Patrol this morning, and this was brought to my attention just yesterday. But the California Highway Patrol website has a special section for recruiting military personnel. It actually goes on to state former military personnel easily fit into the California Highway Patrol's workforce and adapt well to our paramilitary work environment. You can use your former military schools and self-initiative to help you promote through the CHP's ranks. It also says this. It says they continue to admit that they will promote military applicants further down the long hiring process, regardless of their test scores. The California Highway Patrol has a lot to offer for those with military experience. For example, Veterans Preference Program, applicants who have served in the United States Armed Forces as defined in Government Code Section 18540 and who qualify as a veteran are entitled to Veterans Preference. If a veteran passes the certification test, they will move to rank one of the eligibility list regardless of their passing score. Rank one for the CHP means that the veteran applicant will they'll go into backgrounds. But this is why I'm bringing this story up, is because we are going to have probably the guest that I am the most excited about ever next Tuesday on the show. His name is Commander Dale Brown. He runs the Detroit Threat Management Center, and which is a private police department. They have got the most amazing track record of nonviolent intervention. They will not hire ex-military people. They only hire police officers who are truly altruistic. Commander Dale Brown gives his officers the tools that they need to completely eliminate the option of a situation going violent. He literally gives them 1,000 different ways to make sure a situation does not turn violent. So the reason that I'm so excited is A, I want to share his ideas with everyone, but B, his plan, and it's not just a plan, not just a flash in the pan idea here. This is something that he has had on the books and working as a model for 2 decades now. 2 decades. This is the solution. This is the solution to law enforcement problems in our country, is the model that Commander Dale Brown will be bringing to the program next Tuesday. And the program that we're talking about is the Detroit Threat Management Center. So again, you can see the juxtaposition between a successful police department like Commander Dale Brown's, where all of their officers are altruistic, versus the California Highway Patrol, which is not only asking specifically for ex-military people, but is promoting them through the ranks, regardless of their scores, just based on the fact that they have military experience, and really linking that to the idea that their work overall, according to the California Highway Patrol, classifies as paramilitary work or in a paramilitary work environment, which to me is moving in the exact opposite direction of the direction that we need to be moving in. So again, the show is just taking off, ladies and gentlemen. The guests that we've got, man, I'll tell you, Fletch and Robert, the guys behind the scene, the co-creators, do so much work at getting the website awesome and keeping the guests coming. And I'll tell you what, when they told me that Commander Dale Brown was going to be on the show, I just about had a heart attack, because I have been wanting to speak with this man for like 6 months now. And it's specifically because of stories like this and the Highway Patrol in California being ridiculous. And then another story. Here's another great one coming out of Colorado. The Denver cops have now arrested the man who exposed them beating a man on video while promoting the cop. Okay, so we had this story last week of the Denver police officer who was repeatedly punching a guy in the face, causing his head to bounce on the pavement. And then he tripped his pregnant wife, remember that, who fell basically onto her stomach, onto the concrete. It has now sparked an FBI investigation into the department. Okay, but just this weekend, the guy who recorded the incident, and they stopped him from recording the incident. They actually took his tablet away from him and arrested him at the time. But his video of the incident was actually uploaded to the cloud. So he had actually been able to preserve, which is why we were able to talk about it, because the video came out. Well, obviously the Denver police are pretty upset about it, because they came back this weekend and arrested Levi Frazier, right? They arrested him again, based up on some sort of newly activated traffic warrant, according to the department there, because he supposedly missed a court date or failed to provide insurance proof or, whatever, registration proof at a traffic stop a few months ago. So they've now arrested him again. Seems pretty likely that, it's just based on retaliation. But you can see this police officer, Charles Chris Jones IV, on video punching this suspect in the face and then tripping his wife. But good thing is he probably won't be on the street as much anymore, because he's been promoted to sergeant. Yay! Gosh, I hate stories like this. Just drive me absolutely crazy. Hey, here's another one. Brownville, Texas. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officer working on the Texas border remains behind bars right now because he is facing federal drug trafficking and bribery charges for his alleged involvement with Mexican drug traffickers. Oh my gosh. Jose Zavala, who's a 30-year-old CBP officer, he was arrested Friday by agents with Homeland Security Investigations and the DEA for taking money from Mexican drug traffickers in exchange for allowing drug shipments to come through his inspection lane at the Gateway International Bridge in the border city of Brownsville, Texas. And this is, of course, according to information released by the U.S. Attorney's Office to Breitbart. The investigation against Zavala began on the 19th of November when he was working at the bridge, and a van loaded up with 2,900 pounds of marijuana drove into his lane. The driver presented a U.S. passport at Zavala's booth, but the vehicle was then randomly selected for secondary inspection, which was out of Zavala's control, according to the information again provided to Breitbart. The driver of the van got out and he ran back to Mexico, and the agents, of course, found the nearly 3,000 pounds of marijuana inside the van. and the drugs were in plain view with no real effort put into hiding them. Agents with the HSI, DEA, and Homeland Security said that they looked at Zavala's personal cell phone, discovered he had been making and receiving text messages to coordinate payments that he would receive for the smuggling of drugs. So is it any wonder, again, why these draconian drug laws are still on the books? Could it possibly have anything to do with the fact that the agencies responsible for enforcing them are making a whole lot of money? And here's a situation where one of the agents just kind of dipped his finger into the cookie jar a little too far, perhaps, and got caught. But again, you know, eliminate the problem, legalize it. That's all I got to say about that. Anyway, let's see here. Moving on, another, I don't know why there's so many awful law enforcement stories today, guys. I guess maybe to make up for the good law enforcement story we had yesterday. But this has been another startling video out of Texas as a Texas cop uses a stun gun on a 76-year-old man for expired registration tags on his vehicle. The main problem with this story is that it was a loaner car loaned to this guy from a dealership. So really, it wasn't even his job to have the registration sticker up to date. So anyway, Texas officer, this is all on video. You can go see this. If you go to redpillreports.com, go into the news section. This is a Ben Swan article. It's right there under national news. Texas police officer placed on administrative duty, read, paid vacation, after a dashboard camera video emerged showing the 23-year-old officer aggressively detain and tase a 76-year-old man after pulling him over for an expired registration sticker. On the dash cam video, Robinson can be seen arresting Vasquez. That is the elderly man's name. The elderly man exits his vehicle to show the officer that the plates are exempt because they are, as I said, dealer tags. But Robinson decides to grab him by the arm before shoving him onto the hood of his police car. As Vasquez, obviously, who is bewildered, attempts to escape the assault of the police officer and is wrestled to the ground. The two men move out of the frame of the camera, but Victoria police do confirm that it was at this point that Robinson used a stun gun on Vasquez twice while Vasquez was on the ground. So police brutality using a stun gun against a 76-year-old man. But this guy was pretty upset. He actually called the man a Nazi to his face, which I kind of appreciate. And so now the chief of police actually came out and personally apologized to Mr. Vasquez, and Officer Robinson's investigation or his actions are currently under investigation. So we'll see if anything happens from that. I imagine he'll probably get promoted, but we'll see. Weird electrical issue happening in D.C. yesterday, as authorities say an electrical transformer explosion caused power outages at several government buildings in Washington, including the Federal Reserve, the General Service Administration, the Smithsonian subway station at the Metro, the Labor Department, and the U.S. Park and Police, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation all had their power go out yesterday, which is unusual because there's no possible way in the history of the world that that could possibly happen. Just saying, all those places have backup power. They're all independent. There's no way that one thing could take out all of that unless it was a planned hack. They also go on to say in the article that the lights flickered on and off at the lighthouse as well, but that appeared to be unrelated. So, right, as if that's unrelated. Obviously, some sort of breach happened, either at, you know, a SCADA level or a hacking level. They actually do say that there were some State Department computers hacked at the same time, but you'll have to go to different articles to try and put those pieces together. I'm trying to do the best I can because when these goofy incidents happen, they really like to spread the details out as far as they can over a lot of different stories. But definitely something unusual happening in Washington yesterday with that power outage, in my opinion. Maybe it's just me. Yeah. Okay. So let's see here. Moving into some economic news. Huge economic news coming out of Russia right now, ladies and gentlemen. Russia just announcing last night that they would hike its key interest rate to 17% effective this morning, citing rising devaluation and inflation risks. The bank had raised the rate to 10.5% just last week in an effort to stymie the run on its currency. And when they did that, it was a result of the ruble slipping from 45 rubles to the dollar to 65 rubles to the dollar. So before they made that increase to 10.5%, we saw nearly a 50% decrease in the value of the ruble. And as of today, let's move over into Breitbart and see what the ruble is at right now. Looking like $80. We have already slipped to $80 a ruble right now. So that is a record in terms of the devaluation of their currency right now. as much as 19%. It was actually trading at $72.99 last night amid speculation that Russia today will have to resort to some sort of capital controls to stymie again, try and get this deflation to happen or to cease. They are calling, as I said, a meeting to discuss the financial crisis. And this is the biggest currency drop since 1998. I should point out here also that in 1998, Russia actually raised its tax rate, or I'm sorry, its interest rate, to 150%. So let's just put this into a little bit of perspective. It could get a lot worse for them, but the idea right now is that, the interest rate increase doesn't seem to be doing anything to, slow the loss of value of the ruble. So what will happen today? It's kind of difficult to say. Obviously, let's move over into the energy sector here, and I'll keep you guys up to date. We are looking at $55.89 for a barrel of oil right now, well below the $60 mark that we've talked about with a lot of very smart people on the program, saying that $60 is going to be pretty much the go, no-go for the shale industry here in the United States. But obviously Russia majorly taking a hit as a result of those low oil prices. And OPEC in the news right now saying that they will again maintain output at 30 million barrels of oil today, and they want to monitor the price for 3 months even before considering a meeting about possible changes. So we're talking about, you know, March, April, May at the onset where OPEC may decide to step back in. But they are saying really distinctly again this Sunday at a conference in Dubai that they're not going to change their minds just because the oil went down to $60 or $40. They go on to say that they're not targeting a price. The market will stabilize itself. And essentially that's what's going to happen. OPEC is effectively not going to cut their production. So what's going to happen as a result of that? Well, there have been now some energy firms in crisis amid these collapsing oil prices, and the insolvencies of these countries have tripled just in the last year. And there are still right now about 55 billion euros worth of future oil projects which are currently facing uncertainty. So there are not only the factors of, you know, continuing to try and move things out of the ground at a cost effective rate, but there are still a lot of people out there that want to drill new wells. You know, they want to increase their ability to explore, and all of that exploratory stuff, all of the new well drilling, all of that takes money. And right now, with such a low return on investment, the banks are just not going to release that to these companies and allow them to go moving forward. So this issue with oil is really going to affect a lot of things, and I think that the more we see this going forward, the more we're going to see that. There's an article here from Zero Hedge that Tyler Durden just did this morning saying Empire Fed crashes to almost two-year lows and also cites the biggest miss in 4 years. He goes on to say that it must be the weather, because obviously lower gas prices are unambiguously good for everyone, but the Empire Fed manufacturing survey collapsed to negative 3.6%, all the way down from a positive 10.16%. This is its lowest since January of 2013, missing expectations of a rebound to 12.4%, which was a miss, the largest miss of expecting rebounds in 4 years. New orders right now plunged, and unfulfilled orders utterly collapsed from negative 7.45 all the way down to negative 23.76, or as some would call it, unambiguously bad. The timing of this U.S. macro data collapse could not be better for the Fed, of course, which with the entire world reeling from a demand crunch, which we're obviously talking about oil here, needs an excuse to keep lower for longer on the table, and we're talking about their interest rates here, and even proceed with quantitative easing number four if and when needed. So Tyler Durden pretty clear at this point that the Fed probably going to keep low interest rates on the table for a very long time, and potentially might be readdressing quantitative easing, which would of course spike the stock market again. I mean, it's just going to be a crazy roller coaster ride, and I just, man, I'll tell you what, I can't wait to talk to Andrew Gauss on Friday, try and get my head around some of what is going on right now. In a kind of an unusual, goofy note, there is a young man who is 17 from a New York high school. He has made $72 million fortune trading stocks on his lunch break. The young investor is hoping to become a billionaire next year. It's a really interesting story coming out of RT, just showing that if you plan ahead and actually, work your plan, he plans on being a billionaire next year. He's already got a BMW, can't drive, already owns a big old apartment in Manhattan, although his parents won't let him move out. His name is Mohammed Islam. He is 17 years old and, well on his way to opening his first hedge fund. So very interesting, that there are still some successes to be had. Oh, I got to talk about this quick story regarding preparation. This big storm that hit California over the weekend, obviously the largest one in 5 years, but not everybody was prepared for it, which is really hard to believe because there was like a 3-day heads-up warning on this one. Okay, so one San Francisco resident in particular highlights just how susceptible America is to disasters and what to expect in the event of a widespread emergency. This lady, Beth Ludwig, she said, "I thought we were just going to sit around and watch TV all day, but now there's no power here. And my kids have never experienced a power outage before." Another lady, Georgia, was one of the hundreds of thousands in the Bay Area who lost one of the most conveniences of modern life, obviously power. She also said she couldn't get her car out of the garage. She had no food. I have no cash, so I'm trying to forage for something. And the storm that swept over California really wasn't that severe. Plus, there was a lot of advanced warning. So take this into your hearts, ladies and gentlemen, that you don't know what's going to happen, and it only takes a small turn of events to make all that preparation pay off in the long run. And, you know, there are so many people there that were not prepared, and that really breaks my heart because, you know, with quality products out in the world like Namana Foods, you can be ready to get, you know, you could be ready to have, in the event of anything, you can have prepared food. You can be ready to go. So anyway, Namana Foods, I go check them out. That's just a little plug. Let's see here. Moving away from some economic stuff, I just got a report over Skype that the story about the kid who was getting rich was fake. So forget I said anything about that. Let's just move on to science and technology. I have an interesting little blurb here that came across the wire regarding the 440 and... we had that discussion with Elsie Vincent talking about how the Rockefeller Institution the Rockefeller family essentially institutionalized a change in Western music theory, moving us away from 440 or moving us away from the natural note of 432 being A to 440. Anyway, Prince, a lot of you guys might know the musician Prince. Well, Prince just over the weekend participated in a 3-hour Facebook question and answer session. Kind of. He actually was not there for the entire 3 hours after it officially started and actually ended up only answering one question during the whole thing. So what was the question that Prince, you know, ostensibly one of the greatest musicians ever in the history of the world, what was the one question that he answered? Well, the question was from DJ Foji, and he says, "Greetings, my dear brother. Please address the importance of all music being tuned to 432 sound frequencies. Thank you in advance. Warmest regards, Emmanuel." Okay, so that is the one question that Prince decided to answer, and this was his response. Quote, unquote, the gold standard. That's all he said. He also put a link in his response with an article explaining why music should all be converted to 432. But you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Prince himself, the man, the myth, the legend, believes that 432 is the gold standard for musical tuning. And I thought that was pretty interesting because I would be very surprised if Bono has any inclination about real music. Anyway, moving away from that, let's talk about Anonymous hacking the Swedish government email accounts because they were really mad about the Pirate Bay servers being taken by Swedish police. They've also claimed to hack the government emails of Israel, India, Brazil, Argentina, and Mexico. But right now, it appears that the Pirate Bay is back online, although the new website is .cr or and a lot of people who have been using are noting that downloads are probably not really working. There's actually been some indication that you might have to pay for a service there now, and a lot of people are thinking that might be sort of a scam. And while another well-known torrent site, ISO Hunt, officially restructured the site under
old Pirate Bay, and so that one is up and running right now. I don't know personally. I don't have any knowledge of torrents or what these sites and things are, but I know that other people out there might be interested, so that's why I brought that up. Oh, that's a total lie, but whatever. Okay, so Sony, in relation to their big hack that's going on, has now approached media organizations just this weekend and asked them to stop publishing information contained in the documents stolen by hackers. The New York Times, Hollywood Reporter, and Variety have all published stories reporting that they have either received from these hacks, but they've all received now a letter from David Boyce, who is the attorney for Sony, demanding that the outlets stop reporting information contained in the documents and immediately destroy them. So obviously Sony getting upset about some of the disclosures that are coming out. Interesting stuff that's actually been coming out. But on a related note, over the weekend, a message claiming to be from the Guardians of Peace, of course, they are the hacking group that is claiming responsibility for hacking Sony and disseminating all of these top secret documents and things. They said on a site this weekend that they are preparing for Sony a Christmas gift. Very thoughtful of them, but they go on to spoil the gift by saying it will be a larger quantity of data and it will be much, much more interesting. So Sony, not out of the woods yet in terms of their information. I'll tell you that right now. So much news going to be to you here, guys. Apologies, but I want to give you some things here. There's been a study in flu shots can harm your infant and your fetus. Obviously, a lot of you in the show know that is probably pretty accurate. Really interesting story coming out of Kazakhstan right now. Villagers there are suffering from an unknown brain-affecting disease resulting in sleepiness. And we're talking about sleepiness for days and weeks on time. Every 10th villager of Kazakhstan's Kaliki has experienced falling asleep unexpectedly in broad daylight. Some unable to wake up for 7 days. Numerous attempts to find the cause of this inexplicable disorder, the sleepy hole still remains unresolved. There are only 600 residents in this village in Kazakhstan's north, and they may have never read Washington Irving's Legend of Sleepy Hollow, but that's in turn what they're calling their area right now, and everyone is pretty afraid of this indiscriminate illness because so far they haven't been able to identify it. They've been suffering from the sleep epidemic is what they're calling it for the last couple years. Everyone in the village has a family member or friend who's just fallen asleep for no apparent reason, with over 100 people having experienced it by now, some more than one. Very, very unusual. And in recent cases, children started falling down on the first day of school back in September with 8 kids, 8 of them falling asleep within 1 hour. Before that, 20 people fainted and slept for several days, and at least 60 at once in the winter. We laid them in rows, according to an ambulance worker. Just unbelievable. So crazy medical stuff going on over the world. Please go to redpillreports.com and check out all of the health news and all the tech news that I wasn't able to get to. And keep it right here. We got a quick 3-minute break, and then we'll be right back with L.A. Marzulli. Keep it right here, guys.
At Truth Frequency Radio, we bring you the very best personalities in the independent media without the corporate influence and with limited commercial interruption. Over the past year, Truth Frequency Radio has become one of the fastest growing media outlets in the world, and we owe it all to you. That's why with every donation of $30 or more, we'll send you your very own Survive Drive as a way of saying thanks for your continued support. The Survive Drive is jam-packed with nearly 600 ebooks to help you survive everything from everyday life to major disasters. Donate today and we'll continue to wage war against the powers that shouldn't be. Again, thanks for your support and for making Truth Frequency Radio your choice for news without the hate, hype, and fear.
Archaeology, astronomy, alchemy, secrets of the Holy Bible, hidden codes of the Quran, demonology, Tesla technology, solar power, extraterrestrials in the ancient world. more than 500 documentaries, an experimental film lab of cutting-edge music and art, full-length movies, conference reports, and weekly TV shows. The Enigma Channel is the world's first truly global TV station. www.enigmatv.com. Intelligent television for planet Earth.
Doctors don't want you to know about iodine because it allows the body to heal itself quickly and permanently. Iodine Now is a complete powder formulation that will load iodine into the body with vitamin C for the best possible absorption. Iodine Now, available by the case and for protection from radiation, fluoride, chlorine, and bromine, including all heavy metals. We believe that this is the main element that humans need more than any other at this time. This formulation is infused with our bioactive aerobic rare earth nutrient powder that has a powerful negative charge that attracts positive toxins. Why not buy one product that does the job of 20 and saves you space, time, and money, has a storage life of 100 years, all for about $18 a month. Call 888-910-4367 or visit hempusa.org. Call 888-910-4367. 910-4367. Bringing back the universal medicine for mankind. Iodine Now. Only at hempusa.org.
Real people. Real radio.
Initiating the truth frequency.
This is Truth Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you guys for sticking with us through that three-minute break. We are moving into the second hour of our broadcast today, and I am humbled, ladies and gentlemen. I have no other word to describe my feeling for how excited I am to be speaking with the one and only L.A. Marzulli today. For those of you out there who don't know, L.A. Marzulli is an author, he's a lecturer, he's an explorer, I would say. He's a filmmaker. He's written several books about the Nephilim, which are, of course, the giants referred to in the Bible. And he is also a frank supernaturalist. He's lectured on the subject of UFOs, ancient prophetic texts. He's done some of the most amazing work on megalithic sites and structures around the world. I mean, this man is the cream of the crop in terms of ufology and spiritual reality that's going on in the world, as I like to call it. So, L.A., I cannot tell you again how thankful I am for you to join us today, my friend.
Well, J.D., I'm humbled by that introduction. I hope I live up to 20% of it would be really good, but but thanks. I appreciate it.
Well, as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, and I'm not sure if you were there, but the last time you and I spoke was, I want to say, about January of last year. The seventh installment in the Watchers series had just come out. I own all of them up through number seven. So obviously, we have a lot to discuss right now. Before the eighth installment came out, I know that you were planning on heading back down to Peru. You were doing some investigatory research down there. And so I definitely want to talk about everything that essentially has transpired in the last year. But before we do that, do you want to maybe just enlighten people as to the nature of your research and to why it is, you know, that you go to Peru, why it is that you go around the world doing all of the things that you do? And then we'll kind of encapsulate that in a nutshell and then move into current stuff, if that's good with you, sir.
Well, that sounds like a good place to start. I've written 9 books on the UFO phenomena or the Nephilim, either directly or indirectly, talking about the phenomena. I believe that the Nephilim is really important and a very important biblical study, although many people would poo-poo that idea. But the reason for this is we go back into Genesis 3, and we read right back in the beginning of this whole drama that we're in, this cosmic chess match, if you please, between the Most High God and the fallen cherub. We read that there's going to be a seed war, because what we get is we get this pronouncement from the Most High God, and the scene is this. They're in the garden. It's after the fall. Adam and Eve are there, obviously. The fallen cherub is there, and Father God is there. And he basically says, your seed, pointing to the serpent, will be at enmity with the seed of the woman. Mm-hmm. And that sets up the rest of the Bible, in my opinion. We are looking at a seed war. The seed of the Messiah, of course, the seed of the woman, I should say, winds up as the Messiah. And the seed of the serpent will wind up as the Antichrist. And this is what we see happening all through this, you know, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 year drama, which is continuing right now. We know that the Messiah has already come. Yeshua came 2,000 years ago. Jesus came 2,000 years ago, the seed of the woman. We celebrate this at Christmas, and that can open up a whole hornet's nest of, you know, stuff, and I won't even attempt to address it. Mm-hmm. You know, believe as you want to believe and act as you want to act, and that's basically as much as I'll say about that. But the bottom line is, we know he came. That's what we're celebrating. He incarnated on this planet. He became one of us. He was truly a God-man, and through his sacrifice, his willing sacrifice on Calvary, when he shed his blood, by believing on him and confessing our sins, believing that he's the Savior, we can have eternal life. And we get snatched out of the matrix. The prince of the power of the air is still in control of this planet. And when we become spirit-filled and born again, we begin to come out of the world system, the world's matrix of ideas and the paradigm which it beholds. So the Nephilim is really important, and that's why I'm on it. And this, of course, ties into the modern-day UFO phenomena, which is real, burgeoning, and not going away, as I say countless times. Mm-hmm. But the two are inexorably connected, in my opinion.
Well, and I want to interject there, too, because, you know, essentially what you're talking about with the coming Messiah is spirituality manifesting in the physical world. That's we have so many history documents, and not just from the Bible, but from all kinds of historical documents, talking about the transition between the spiritual and the physical. It's gone on so often. So that's what is so interesting to me about your work, is that you're looking for evidence around the world of that spiritual manifestation into this physical plane that we're in. And it's funny to me how some people will discount that, say, well, that's not Christian, or that's not something that we would be discussing if we're talking about the Bible. But man, that's what it's chock full of, is spiritual stuff manifesting in the physical plane. Why would that have stopped? Why would it not be important to continue to look at that now? You know, it's just, it's astounding to me sometimes the disconnect, that exists there in the minds of people.
Well, the disconnect is very real, and there's an anti-supernatural movement, mm-hmm. Actually among Christians that deny any type of supernatural occurrence in modernity, and they do so with great diligence on their blogs, on their negative spins that they put on things. I'll tell you one thing. There's this one guy who's a disinformation agent. I'm not going to honor him by stating the guy's name, but, you know, recently I published a book called On the Trail of the Nephilim, Volume 2, and what was interesting is we have these series of photographs taken from Catalina, and this guy immediately proceeds to tell us that the photograph was staged, but he offers no proof as to how he comes to that conclusion. Mm. In other words, he just states something because that's what he hopes is real. Well, that's called lying, or that's called, you know, stretching the facts to fit your paradigm. He never, ever goes into the triple blind study that we did create that is published in the book, which talks about that skeleton was about 9 feet tall. I recently appeared on History Channel's new series, In Search of the Lost Giants, and they had my photograph up there, and they gave credit to the Vieira brothers, which was false. The Vieiras did not discover it. I discovered it and sent it to Jim. That's the truth, and which is fine. They can spin it how they want to spin it. It's their show. But they had me on because I had the analysis of the photograph. So here's, we've got this one so-called self-proclaimed debunker who just blatantly states a falsehood. The photograph was staged. The guy's never done a modicum of research. He just fires away, and it makes you wonder, why is he so concerned with spreading falsehoods, lies, innuendos? What is he so afraid of? Mm-hmm. That he can't actually look at the evidence, and instead of attacking me, which is what he does constantly, in an ad hominem attack, which is what they always do, he never, ever goes after the real evidence. In other words, He'll say the photograph was staged. Well, how convenient is that? Says who?
Right.
You know, right? He has no proof of that, but he never goes into the analysis that we did by three different people with three different computer software programs to show that, in fact, that skeleton was about 9 feet tall. And here's the rub. Why would Glidden in 1919, when he discovered this particular skeleton, working for the High Museum, why would he jeopardize his career by creating a ruse? And if he did create a ruse, why didn't we hear about this until I published the photograph?
Yeah, why would you make a ruse and then hide it from everybody?
Exactly. So the whole argument is just a straw man argument, mm-hmm. and basically collapses of its own weight. But this is the type of nonsense that's out there. Meanwhile, we're doing real hardcore scientific evidence. We've gone into the lab. We've done Raman spectroscopy. We've done scanning electron microscopic analysis. We're in the lab. We're doing stuff. We're looking at the evidence and trying to figure out by the scientific method what we're looking at. And then we publish those findings. Sometimes we have a hypothesis, and that is that many of these ancient megalithic structures seen around the world are in fact fallen angel technology. Mm-hmm. And that this is what we have come to call Nephilim architecture. A perfect example of this would be the remains of these megalithic walls found in Sacsayhuaman, Peru. And that's the reason why we keep going back to Peru, because Peru is incredibly enigmatic. But I got to tell you something, JD. Mm-hmm. Here in the States, there's a lot of different sites all over the United States which are difficult to access because they're completely controlled. Mm-hmm. But they do exist here. But in Peru, yes, Sacsayhuaman is certainly controlled. But you know what? I can go up and place my hands right on the stones. I can look at a 120-ton polygonal-shaped rock that was quarried 40 miles away and that was certainly found, was there pre-Columbian, because when the conquistadors came in at the time of conquest and asked the Inca who built these, they just stated, it was here when we got here, but giants built it.
Yeah.
what's astounding is that these rocks are placed in perfect symmetry. No two rock is the same. They are polygonal. In other words, they're not square. They're polygonal, many-sided angles. Sometimes some of the angles wind up in a curve. It's incredibly playful. No mortar is used. And, 120 boulders. And I've shown these pictures to architects and other archaeologists. I'm not an archaeologist, but archaeologists. I've shown them to engineers. And they just kind of stare at them and scratch their head. And, well, they must have had a technology which has been lost to mankind, L.A. Well, isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
Isn't that convenient? Because, see, what they can't do is they can't accept anything supernatural, because most people in academia and the scientific community cling tenaciously to the Darwinian paradigm. Mm-hmm. So there is no supernatural for them. And you stated in your opening that I am a frank supernaturalist. And I point... and again, that's the paradigm I embrace, and I'm stuck with it. But it's a biblical paradigm, because if we take the supernatural events out of the biblical narrative, what are we left with? Hardly anything at all.
A fairly short story, yeah.
Short story.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that strikes me about these megalithic structures, and here's where I want to kind of get into the prophecy angle, because one of the things that I wonder about the prophecy coming out of the Bible and the biblical text, because obviously it's very accurate. We've seen a lot of that stuff come to fruition. But I always look at these megalithic sites, and a lot of them to me appear to have been destroyed in some way. And to me, I think, okay, well, if they had the technology that they would need to build these things, then perhaps they had technology that could have created some kind of super weapon, that could knock these things out. Cause you look at some of these sites and it really looks like there's just chaos, just complete destruction has occurred there. So I wonder if some of the prophetic instances are based on the rise and the fall of civilization, either pre-flood or pre-whatever the major tech war that happened on the planet. And, because the evil, if you want to call it that, the evil influence working on the hearts and the minds of men would have existed in those days. We see that in the Bible. It says, the Nephilim were on the earth then, before the days of Noah, and then after also. So I kind of wonder if some of that prophetic stuff is just them looking back at what has already happened and said, wow, that was the path that we were on. We got to this high point and blew ourselves up. I can imagine that that's what's going to happen again. What do you think about that?
Well, you certainly make a very good case for something cataclysmic happened. When we go to ruins like Pumapunku or Ollantaytambo, Pumapunku is in Bolivia, mm-hmm. about 13,000 feet above sea level. Ollantaytambo is in the Sacred Valley in Peru. There are similarities. Both sites seem to have been destroyed in something incredibly cataclysmic. These huge megalithic stones at Ollantaytambo have been knocked down. Pumapunku, it looks like something just decimated the place, and we don't know what. Some of the stones are actually still intact in the ground, in their you know, original position, but much of it has been carted away. In fact, when you go to Tiwanaku, which is right next to Pumapunku in Bolivia, in the square, there is a picnic table. We actually photographed this. There's a picnic table, and the picnic table is made from stones carted out from Pumapunku. So, yeah, we have no idea what the structure looked like at this point. We also know that when the railroad came through decades ago, that they took the stones and pulverized them to use for the stones for the railroad bed. Hmm. So, I mean, what did the structure look like? We really don't know. Right. What was it used for? A lot of speculation there. I believe it was not a temple. It was a machine of some sort, as much of these sites globally were part of this intricate grid system that was used by the ancients. When I talk about ancients, I'm talking about this is fallen angel technology. Mm-hmm. This is Nephilim architecture. That's what we've come to call it. And what's interesting here, JD, when we go to the Book of Enoch, and I understand, you know, the Book of Enoch is, you know, a pseudepigraphal book, and we can't use it as part of our canon. I get it. I mean, I understand that. But listen to what some of these things says, some of the scripture said. Let me try that again, because I'm trying to read and talk at the same time. I can't do that.
No problem.
Let's examine what some of this says and go from there. This is talking about the 200 watcher angels that descended in the days of Jared. And all the others together with them took unto themselves wives, and each chose for himself one. That mirrors the Genesis 6 account. When the sons of God saw the daughters of men, they chose wives, okay? Uh-huh. And they began to go into them and to defile themselves with them. And they taught, get this, they taught them charms and enchantments, the cutting of roots, and made them acquainted with plants. And they became pregnant, and they bare great giants. Let me move. And they began to sin against the birds, the beasts, the reptiles, and fish, devour one another's flesh. This gets really nasty. Now listen to this. One of the fallen angels taught men to make swords and knives and shields, the breastplates, and made known to them the metals of the earth and the art of working them, and bracelets and ornaments, and the use of cosmetics and beautifying the eyelids, and all kinds of costly stones. And there arose much godlessness. Semyaza taught enchantments and root cuttings, or Armoros, the resolving of enchantments, Barakil, astrology, Cocobel, the constellations. I mean, it is unbelievable what's going on here. In other words, they are giving knowledge of these things to mankind. Uh-huh. And indeed, that was the quid pro quo. Basically, let us have the women and we'll show you some really cool stuff. And so, yeah, the men go, okay, sure, far out. Well, when we skip to modernity, we hear this exact same thing, exact same scenario that allegedly happened in the Truman-Eisenhower administration. In other words, Truman did it, and then Eisenhower carried it on when there was this, okay, let us have access to the women population for abductions, and we'll tell you who it is we're abducting. We'll give you some toys to play with. And apparently that happened in the late 40s, early 50s. Can I prove that? No, I can't. But interestingly enough, Philip Corso, in his book, sort of leads the reader to believe that that actually happened. So that is just mirroring the days of Noah, which, by the way, Jesus warns us it'll be like the days of Noah when he returns. Even that is controversial. Well, that's not really what he means to say, in that Noah's day there was wickedness and they were eating and drinking and giving in marriage. No. Who's the they? Who is they referring to in that passage of Matthew 24? The student of the Bible must go back to Genesis 6, and the they in Genesis 6 are not human beings. They are given and taken in marriage? No, that's the fallen angelic host, the sons of God. And this is what's so important about the interpretation, the exegesis of the biblical narrative in Genesis 6. Unless we get it right and understand who the sons of God were, which were the fallen angelic host, and many seminaries do not teach that. They teach what's known as the Sethite theory, which came to be in about the 3rd century. No one believed this nonsense until about the 3rd century. The rabbis all knew what was going on. Josephus knew what was going on. The early church fathers knew what was going on. Then, Augustine comes in and, well, we've got to switch things because the supernatural is really sloppy. And that's what happens.
Wow.
That changes the whole paradigm. The Sethite theory becomes the status quo. And now most seminarians, unfortunately, embrace the Sethite theory. And so when you're in church and you hear about the giants, you always hear, are the giants in your life? What are the giants in your life that you have to slay? They missed the whole point of it. Right. Goliath was a Nephilim. That what was there. That's what the whole idea when Joshua and Caleb go into the promised land, the Levant, the Canaan, and they're given this mandate by the Most High God to wipe everybody off out there from the land. That's genocide, unless we're looking at something else that is happening. And the something else is happening, we're told in the text, who is there? The Nephilim are there. The Rephaim, the Zamzumim, the Emims, the Canaanites, they're all there. The Amorites, they're all part of a Nephilim cadre of tribes. They're there.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, we believe our hypothesis is this, that when Joshua and Caleb go into the promised land, these Nephilim tribes see what's going on and they leave. Some of them bail. Some flee northward into Europe and wind up in the Americas. Some get on boats, go out the Mediterranean into the Atlantic. And Thor Heyerdahl in his classic work, Ra, and Kon-Tiki, Kon-Tiki's the first, Ra's the second. Kon-Tiki, when he sails from, I think, Peru out to Tahiti and prove that it can be done, with just a boat and a sail. And then he does the same thing in a papyrus boat. He sails out of Egypt, out of the Nile, and winds up in the Gulf of Mexico or, you know, South America. Mm-hmm. He proved it can be done. So why not in antiquity? There's no law except for archaeologists who insist it didn't. And yet we see the evidence that it probably did. So the tribe scattered. And if that's the case, then do we see evidence in the Americas? In my opinion, the resounding answer to that is yes. And that's why we're on the trail. If that's true, we should see remnants of giant skeletons. And guess what? We do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's at stake here. Because I've got one of the only photographs on the planet that we've been able to find. And I've been on this trail a long time that actually shows photographic evidence. And I believe that they missed it. Let me explain what I mean. Let me get a slurp of water and I'll tell you what I mean.
Okay.
There was a cache of records that was found by the former curator of the Catalan Museum, John Borgina, about 3 years ago now. And John found this trunk up in the attic above the museum. And he opened it up, and lo and behold, it's the lost Ralph Glidden records, journals, photographs. Ralph Glidden was an archaeologist in the early part of the 20th century who was hired by the High Museum. Later on, he created this very macabre museum, had no respect for the remains of Native Americans, and I get that. What he did was absolutely atrocious. I understand that.
I hate to interrupt. I'm just curious, though. There was a story just this week about, I want to say it was that same person that they discovered a hidden chamber in his office behind a bookshelf or something and all kinds of new artifacts.
No, that's the what's his name? Flanders Petrie.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Yeah, he was the one that did the, and I'm trying to vet that story because it's very interesting.
Okay, good.
He's the one who measured the Great Pyramid and just said, look, there's no way human beings
are hopeless.
And frankly, I agree with them.
Did you hear that story about the Smithsonian disclosure that I accidentally broke last week, thinking that it was real, where the Smithsonian had been sued into disclosing, the 100 years?
This is what the problem is. Think about this. Why did that story come out? Just think about it.
To mess up my radio show, because they knew I would get excited about it, and they knew I would think, L.A. is someplace jumping up and down with joy right now, and how great is this going to be that we're actually getting someplace? That's what I thought.
The moment I saw it, I wrote the person back and said the story's a canard. The moment I saw it, I didn't address it on the blog, but I knew it was fictitious. I went to the source of the story and read it. Just nonsense. They make this stuff up. And here's the deal, JD. They do it to sucker us in. They do it to make us look like we have egg on our face.
Mm-hmm.
And that story has been circulating rumors. I've heard it from people who heard it from a former employee from the Smithsonian, but I've never gone public with it because you can't.
Right.
There's no way to vet it. You know, I can't check the veracity of that report, but what I can do is go to Catalina. And when John Borgina found these photographs in journals, I got wind of it from Jim Watson, who wrote a book, Mysterious Catalina. And Jim and I had dinner and, you know, we were talking about Glidden's work and, he arranged for me to see the remains of Glidden's collection at the Fowler Museum at UCLA. And I went there and spoke to one of the archaeologists and also a forensic anthropologist who assured me there were no giant skeletons found. That, how convenient is that? And when I went into the back room and saw row after row of skulls, they were all Native Americans, the best of my, there was nothing anomalous with them at all.
Okay.
I did bring one of the cast of elongated skulls from Peru. And when I showed it to the forensic anthropologist, he quickly handed it back and said, cradle headboarding. And I said, look again. And as he began to examine it, his jaw dropped. He said, where'd you get this? And I told him, I said, we believe that this is not cradle headboard. It is genetic. And I'll talk about that a little earlier, how we have now uncovered, thanks to Brian Forrester and other folks, a journal from 1842. And since I'm talking about it, I suppose I should probably at least talk about that. But this is what this is a journal in 1842. And even back then, this controversy is raging between elongated skulls being cradle headboarded. That's when you take a child and you wrap the head and you create this cone head shape over a period of a couple of years.
Well, and one could stop and ask why that they would be doing that also.
Why would they be doing that? Why wake up on a Monday morning and say, why is the shape desired?
Yeah.
and there's another group that said, no, some of it's cradle headboarded, but other parts, others seem to be genetic. So this is what they write, 1842, and there's a hand-drawn sketch, which I include in the book, which is just fantastic, 1842 before photography on these journeys and expeditions. You would take a field artist, or you yourself were trained to be a field artist. So there's a frontal view and a side view of this elongated skull. But listen to what they say, talking about what they just discovered. We ourselves observed the fact in many mummies of children of tender age, who, although they had cloths about them, were yet without any vestige or appearance of pressure of the cranium. More still, the formation of the head presents itself in children yet unborn. And of this truth, we have had convincing proof in the sight of a fetus enclosed in the womb of a mummy of a pregnant woman, which we found in a cave 2 leagues from Tarma. So they found a mummy, and when they unwrapped the mummy, they found out she was pregnant.
Right.
And then they went in to see what the fetus looked like. And there they found a mummified fetus that had not been taken from the womb, obviously, and it had an elongated skull. So,
wow.
Is it conclusive proof? No, it's not. But the deal is this. It continues to point in the direction that there's an outside agency influencing the genome.
Yes. Okay, we're zooming up on a break here, and I hate to interrupt you. I do want to recommend, and I forgot to do this earlier, everybody go to lamarzulli.net. Is that the best website for you, sir?
Correct.
They can get to your blog from there.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can find all of the books. You can find all of the DVDs and things like that at that site. I also recommend going to the blog because you do a great job of keeping your blog updated every day. And when we come back from the break, I want to ask you about something that I saw on your blog. You'll have to remind me because I may forget over the 3-minute break. But I saw something on your blog the other day that really kind of piqued my curiosity as to what might be going on with your current discovery mode right now. So we'll come back from the break. I'll ask that question. We're going to talk a little bit about, I'd like to get into the alien implant thing. I know that there was some relevant stuff going on with that the last time I spoke with you. And then I'd love to talk a little bit more about these elongated skulls and Peru, and then perhaps even talk a little bit about some of the prophecy that's going on in current events right now. So keep it here, everybody. We got a 3-minute break. We'll be right back with L.A. Marzulli. Thank you guys for tuning in. We'll be right back.
So, you want the news and information without the hate, the hype, the fear? Well, you've come to the right place. You can support Truth Frequency Radio by spreading the word on social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter, or your favorite forums. Want to take Truth Frequency Radio on the road? Listen on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or other mobile devices. Want more than just the free stuff? Sign up for a VIP membership for as little as $4 a month and get super high-quality downloads, member-only content, and instant access to your favorite shows without the wait. It's only through your loving support that we're able to cover the cost and continue broadcasting. So now, stay tuned for more Free Speech Radio, right here on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. KTFRN, worldwide.
American gardeners and fellow patriots, make the right choice with your money, time, and your family food supply. Choose 100% pure heirloom seeds in the Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com. Why spend more? The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com is only $37.95 and includes 20 varieties of pure, hardy, easy-to-grow heirloom seeds. Yes, only $37.95. That's 70% less than our competitors. You could buy three Survival Seed Vaults for less than one of theirs. The Survival Seed Vault from MyPatriotSupply.com includes detailed planting and seed saving instructions and ships same day. Plus, all orders over $49 ship free. MyPatriotSupply.com is American owned by patriots like you, passionate about freedom and preparedness. Call now, 866-229-0927. That's 866-229-0927. Or discover more emergency preparedness items when you order at MyPatriotSupply.com. Choose the original. Choose the Survival Seed Vault at MyPatriotSupply.com.
Since our founding in 2005, we at YouTube have continually strived to bring you the best possible video experience on the internet. But now, we're updating YouTube to make it even better and give our users more of what they want.
Ever since our Google Plus integration, we've seen a 30% reduction in racist and bigoted comments. People are even starting to notice the complete lack of bigoted comments, and frankly, they miss them. To make up for this deficit, we have added auto-commenting bots to YouTube Plus that can be set to either type racist or hateful comments. Similar to the auto-comment bot, we've created the auto-spam bot, which allows terrible YouTubers to beg people to watch their horrible excuses for videos they put out. These comments can go out to every video they've ever interacted with.
Hey guys! So we're like really wanting to be filmmakers on YouTube, and we'd totes appreciate it if you come watch our videos and comment, like, and subscribe. That'd be totes amazeballs. Yeah, we really like subscribers.
YouTube Plus. We own you!
The brothers gonna work it out.
Staunching Tyranny with Jim and Jeff Staunch.
Monday on Truth Frequency Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you guys are enjoying this conversation with Ellie Marzulli as much as I am. I have a feeling this will be the fastest hour in the history of the Red Pill Reports radio broadcast because I just have so many questions that it's just mind-boggling, Ellie, to be honest. I want to continue with our discussion about the elongated skull motif. I've got a couple of questions. I wanted to know, first of all, do you feel like they might be related to the Bigfoot phenomenon, the Sasquatch phenomenon that's going on?
What's interesting is in Watchers 8, we sit down with Ron Moorhead. Ron Moorhead has written a fascinating book complete with audio recordings that he actually recorded these entities out in the field in a very remote place in the Sierra Madres. And he believed the reason why Ron went with us is he posited that Bigfoot has a elongated skull, has a sagittal crest. And we got him on record, first of all, stating that he found tracks of a 28-inch tracks. I mean, to give you an idea how big that is, with a stride of about 15 feet between the tracks.
Wow.
In a very, very remote location near this campsite in the Sierra Madres. I mean, this place is out. Let me put it to you this way. You drive for an hour down a dirt road with your horse trailer, and then at the end of the dirt road, you unpack your horses and your mule. You pack, or, you know, you get them out of the trailer. You pack them up with your gear, and you spend the next 8 hours packing in. That's how long and how remote this place is. Now, you can get through the helicopter, but because it's, you know, state forest land, you're not allowed to do that.
Well, the phrase desolation wilderness comes to mind when you...
Well, it is. It's extremely desolate. And that's why he went down to Peru with us, and he came on camera. Ron Moorhead came on camera and said, look, I believe that there's a connection between what we're seeing here, what we believe are Nephilim skulls, and Bigfoot, which we believe now. See, Ron believes, as I do, that Bigfoot is a remnant of the Nephilim. They're interdimensional.
Yes.
That's why the History Channel, you know, Finding Bigfoot, it should really be called Not Finding Bigfoot, because they do.
Right.
Just episode after episode of the same thing over and over and over again. They're never going to find them. If it's interdimensional, and I've spoken to eyewitnesses, JD, this is not second or third information. This is right out of the horse's mouth. that have seen these entities appear and disappear right in front of them.
Yeah, and Native Americans say that. I mean, that if you look at the hundreds of names for Native Americans or for Sasquatch from Native Americans, they all describe a very spiritual nature with that creature. And the reason I brought that up, and I might be, you know, tracking away from the conversation just a little bit, but you mentioned the fact that there's potentially an arrangement that had been made with the Truman administration, the Eisenhower administration, to allow abductions to take place for the exchange of technology. Well, one of the things that I've been following a lot recently is the work of David Politis. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's written a book called The Missing 411.
Very much so. I'm reading one of his books now, the second one.
I mean, astounding information. And it kind of lines up with what you're saying in that we might, A, have some knowledge that these creatures are operating, you know, and that they might be interdimensional, and they might be part of this whole abduction thing. There's certainly something going on in the national parks in our country that the Forest Service is completely aware of that kind of fills in some of the gaps of what we're talking about, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think Pilates, and I've spoken to Dave and emailed him several times. We've never done an interview with him, but we're thinking about including it for a Watchers 9 or Watchers 10 because we believe it's connected. David never really ventures to postulate what he thinks is going on, at least not that I'm aware of, mm-hmm. although he sort of ties it back in with Bigfoot, and I would too, Sasquatch. I mean, I would definitely tie it back in with that. But, you know, what's interesting here is that sometimes Sasquatch or Bigfoot is also found hand in hand with UFO activity.
Right.
We see this over and over again. And I think the two are absolutely related. Thousands of people have gone missing in the parks all across America. Mm-hmm. Thousands of people. And something is going on, and people should be warned before they go into any park that you're hiking into an area where people have gone missing under mysterious circumstances and have never been found. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
so change based on that, maybe we don't go.
Yeah, maybe we change our summer vacation plans this time.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's get back onto the elongated skull issue. I know you were heading back down to Peru the last time I talked to you. What's the status on your discoveries down there right now?
Well, what's interesting, again, that 1842, from that journal from 1842, that little snippet that I read from you, mm-hmm. is extremely telling because these guys have no Nephilim dog in the hunt back then. That's not what's at stake. What's at stake is the unfolding of the idea of the Darwinian paradigm, which was not really published by then, but certainly that idea was being bandied back and forth, that's right in the window where all this was going on. And these guys, you know, one group of academics is saying, oh, this is all cradle headboard. And the other group's going, no, some of it is, but, you know, some of it isn't. And that's what we maintain. We've got preliminary DNA testing that was taken by the late Lloyd Pye. Samples were taken by the late Lloyd Pye out of Senior Juan Paracas Museum. At least I think that's where they came from. I'm not even sure of that.
Hmm.
We've got 15 samples. And we're trying to get them out legally with the proper permits. We're in league with four different archaeologists, one in Spain, two in the United States, and one in Peru, getting all the paperwork to get these out of Peru and do DNA testing on them. And then depending on what the DNA testing comes back, then we would do a proper archaeological dig in Chongos or Camacho or perhaps both places.
Mm-hmm.
We want to see what's underneath the sand, mm-hmm. Instead of the Huacaros doing. Huacaros are grave robbers robbing them. But what's interesting is samples were taken out by the late Lloyd Pye about 4 years ago now, and 3 or 4 years ago. And the geneticist contacted my friend and colleague Brian Forrester, who then contacted me, and this is what the geneticist stated. Whatever the sample labeled 3A has come from, it had mitochondrial DNA with mutations unknown in any human, primate, or animal known so far. The data is very sketchy, though, and a lot of sequencing still needs to be done to recover the complete mitochondrial DNA sequence. But a few fragments I was able to sequence from the sample indicate that if these mutations hold, we are dealing with a new human-like creature very distant from Homo sapiens, Neanderthals, and Denisovans. I am not sure it will even fit into the known evolutionary tree. The question is, if they were so different they could not interbreed with humans, breeding within their small population, they may have degenerated due to inbreeding. That would explain the Berry children. This group was either low or not viable. This fits right in with our hypothesis. And you can't believe the people that came out of the woodwork and attacked this. It's like, whoa, we're talking about kick over the hornet's nest. Right. There was this one woman from a very noted Christian ministry, of which I won't embarrass them by stating their name here, who wrote this scathing article about this. Oh, you know, this is what we just got from the Brian released it. Mea culpa, we know we'll never do anything like this again. That's why we're going through the proper permits. The next time we do this, we'll be at a proper press conference in some city in the United States with everybody prepared statements, the whole deal. Here's the science, here's the geneticist. You know, you do the test and see for yourself. But that's further down the road, and hopefully we'll be able to do that at some point. But this one author stated that, oh, well, the DNA sample was contaminated. And I wrote them back and said, how can you possibly make that assumption? Have you spoken to the geneticist? Do you, in fact, know where the sample came from? Do you know anything, or like this other debunker we talked about in the first half hour, do you just make this stuff up because your paradigm is in jeopardy?
Mm-hmm.
We're just going where the evidence takes us. You know what, JD? If we get the evidence, we get the DNA samples out of Peru, and this collapses, you know, this, oh, I made a mistake. I'm not sure what happened with that sample. These are all, you know, Denisovans or Neanderthals or whatever. There's nothing mysterious about it. Guess what we're going to say? We're going to say that. We're not going to whine and complain. We're going to go back to the drawing board and see whether we abandon the hypothesis or rework the hypothesis. And that's what we're going to do. Look, I'm a born-again, spirit-filled Christian, okay? I believe in Jesus with all my heart. I do not believe in the evolutionary paradigm. I think it's the biggest bunch of hooey that's ever been foisted on the American public and the people of the world. It's just an unproven, ridiculous statement. This whole thing was made by one being who visited us about 2,000 years ago. Anyway, I digress. The bottom line is we're on the trail, and we believe that the DNA evidence will, in fact, point to an outside agency manipulating the genome. And wow, that's what's at stake here. And that's why it's so important to get this evidence out and get it tested and then tell the world what's going on. And that's what we intend to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is interesting too, because it's not just a historical occurrence of a spiritual manifestation in the world in terms of your research, but you also investigate current physical manifestations of spiritual, you know, things showing up on our physical plane. And what I'm talking about right now is obviously the alien implant. I guess that might be too big of a broad of a term, but you found essentially ferrous metal implants in people who have gone through what would classically be defined as abduction stories. So we're talking about current medical conditions that are going on right now. Do you want to talk a little bit about that as well?
Well, I'd love to. And, you know, this is what's so interesting. And I guess I'm spending too much time on defending and attacking the debunkers, but I need to do it again in this case, because about 6-7 years ago, when I started mentioning the whole alien implant, alien abduction, alien implant scenario, once again, all the debunkers came out of the woodwork and laughed and, you know, pointed a finger and then blah, 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 blah. Well, in Watcher 7, we have Bill, and Bill is a man who was abducted when he was 5 years old. So that's 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he claimed to have an implant. Okay. So that's, you know, where that's the tinfoil hat group, right?
Right.
But we've got a guy. And if you have an implant, then it should show up on the X-ray. Sure enough, there's a metallic object underneath Bill's leg. We do a CAT scan. Sure enough, there's a metallic object right underneath Bill's knee. I should say not leg, but knee, kneecap. And, now we've got two scientific tests that were done that show a metallic object below the skin. We take a Gauss meter. A Gauss meter shows and registers magnetic field. Richard Shaw, the director and producer of the Watcher series, along with myself, his camera registered about 10.0 on the Gauss meter, 10.0 milligauss on the Gauss meter. When we put the Gauss meter up to where we thought the implant was, it registered 8.0 to 8.5. JD, How is that possible?
I don't know.
How is that possible?
I don't know.
When we take a stud finder that you buy at Home Depot, guess what? There's a metallic object slightly below Bill's right kneecap. When we take and measure the radio frequency to see if the thing is giving off any type of a signal, we find to our absolute astonishment that it is giving off a signal of about 330 gigahertz. How is that possible? When we take him to the surgeon now to remove it, first thing we notice is there is no point of entry. There is no entry wound.
Okay.
Right above where this implant is. No entry wound, JD. How the heck did it get there?
Mm-hmm.
We take the ultrasound. We take the x-ray. Correlate where the x-ray is, the implant and the x-ray to the actual physical implant below the knee. Make a little black dot there. Dr. Matriciano spreads the gel, takes the ultrasound one. Within less than 2 minutes, he finds the object. Guys, I'll see you in 2 weeks. We'll take the thing out. Great.
Mm-hmm.
So, JD, 2 weeks later, there are three film crews. We have a waiting room with an HD monitor, a widescreen TV monitor there hooked up so the witnesses can watch the proceedings. There's about 15 of them in the room. We've got two doctors, Dr. Matriciano and the late Dr. Roger Lear, who was assisting in the surgery. We have one nurse, various administrators, Richard Shaw, my business partner, co-director or director and co-producer of the Watcher series, and myself are there. Stephen Coburn, chief scientist for A&E, he's there. We're all looking at this thing. And Dr. Matriciano starts the proceedings, takes the x-ray, places it over the patient's knee, takes a little black marker, puts a dot where the implant corresponds to the x-ray, squirts the gel, except this time, JD, he goes back and forth over a little 3-inch by 8-inch strip of flesh. He can't find anything.
What?
He cannot find a thing. And he's growing concerned.
Right.
So at one point he goes, maybe we should get another x-ray. And Dr. Lear looks at him and says, we know it's there. We found it here 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment, and I'm not making this up, at that moment, JD, I got a little tap on the shoulder from the Holy Spirit because I am a spirit-filled, born-again Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And the Spirit of a living God tapped me on the shoulder and basically said, you need to pray. You need to take authority over this. And so I said out loud, because I'm in a room full of non-believers except for Richard Shaw.
Right.
And I go, guys, this is going to sound a little weird, a little strange, but I'm going to pray, and I'm going to do it now. So I didn't wait for permission. I launched into the prayer, which went something like this. Father, if there are forces which are cloaking this device, I pray that you would break their power and do it soon. JD, less than 2 minutes later, all of a sudden the image appears on the screen.
No.
I mean appears. The image floats in. It's not the way the machine works. The image floats in, and we've got that part of it on film.
Wow.
Which is astounding. So the doctor is freaked out.
Right.
He finds this thing. He's taking his wand on and off and on and off, you know, kind of staring at it going like, what the heck just happened? Dr. Lear, 2 days later, when we were in Seal Lab examining the implant, last time I spoke to him, I took him outside one-on-one and I said, you know, I hope you realize what happened in that operating theater. And Dr. Lear's eyes got real big and he said, L.A., I now believe there's a supernatural component to the so-called alien abduction phenomena, and I'm going to tell Whitley Strieber about it. It was the last I ever spoke to him.
Wow.
So we changed, one prayer changed the room. That's spiritual warfare 2.0. And it points once again to the paradigm that what we're looking at here are not extraterrestrial, but interdimensional. I'll be talking about that at the CIRO meeting, January 10th, right here in Los Angeles to a bunch of UFO people. And that's going to be fun. And of course, we will be talking about what happened in the operating theater, on that day. But JD, the skeptics, completely silent about that.
What?
Silent. Not one word.
It's just crazy to me because, I mean, obviously anybody who studies science knows that that the idea of affecting physical matter through intention or through prayer, it's conclusive. You know, you can put that to rest. We know that prayer and intention can affect physical objects. But what's so interesting to me about this is, again, that we see this nexus between spirituality and our physical plane. And I just, you know, that nexus, the existence of that nexus is just so important to understand and to accept. I just can't commend you enough on the work that you're doing. I want to bring it back to a question that I have about your blog. I love your blog, first of all, and everybody go to lamarzulli.net. You can go to LA's blog, which is lamarzulli.wordpress.com, and you do a great job updating that all the time.
Thank you.
But you have a thing on here that really piqued my interest, and it's this "I need your help on two issues" session. Yeah, I'm glad you're laughing because I'm going to keep going with this. One of the things that you're requesting right now, and I'm hoping that this is a recent request, is a request for a forensic pathologist. And for those of you out there who don't know, a forensic pathologist is somebody who would determine causality of death. And you also go on to say that you have some sort of artifact in cold storage. And man, that blew my mind. So if you could give us some insight into that without spilling all the beans, I would love to know what this whole quest for a forensic pathologist is all about.
Well, we have an artifact, and that's about all I can say.
Oh!
We have an artifact that we need to have a forensic pathologist look at.
Okay.
And then based on what he or she states, we will take it to the next step with DNA testing.
Roger that. So is this something that we can expect for the ninth edition of the Watchers series, perhaps?
It would be the ninth. It would also be an Omnitrail Volume 3. Depending on what we do with it, depending on what comes, depending on what we discover, will dictate. If I told you what was going on here, you wouldn't even believe it. It's beyond the pale.
Oh, but that's what we want to hear, though. That's what all the audience is clamoring for.
It is right out of the X-Files. And that's what, you know, my wife and I look at each other. We are the living X-Files. And I'm not saying that, you know, glibly or in a puffed up way. It's like, you know, Mulder are two fictitious characters and on a movie set. You know, we're handling elongated skulls. We've got the Nephilim Lance. We're at all these different places. We're interviewing abductees, contactees, implants. I mean, this isn't a movie. We're making movies out of it, but it's not a movie. It's the real thing.
I have to stop you though, because you just used this phrase, Nephilim Lance. I'm sorry, what now?
Yeah, that's in the book, On the Trail of a Nephilim. You know, JD, we're running out of time. You really should have me back sooner than later.
Oh, I'd love to.
I'd love to get into it more with you, but the Nephilim Lance is what we're calling this particular artifact, which came out of the wilds of Michigan, found at an abandoned campsite, and the owner, Bob Shelley, was walking through the woods, found this abandoned campsite, and was looking around and discovered the artifact, and he backpacked it out. When he did so, he was debating, because of the weight of the thing and the length, it's about 32 inches long, whether to backpack it out or not.
Mm-hmm.
We have got it tested at a metallurgy lab, and it's almost pure copper, but it's a bronze artifact.
Okay.
It's copper and tin. It's been hand beaten. It looks, when we first saw it, Bob Shelley had it for a good long time, always believed it was a sword. When I saw it, I thought too it was a sword. Well, Chief Joseph Riverwind was with me, and moments after I saw it and said, "Wow, that's an awfully large sword," and picked it up and went, "It's, you know, there's no way I can wield this." He looked at us and said, "Guys, you're looking at this through your cultural eyes. It's not a sword. It's a lance."
Wow.
And the oral tradition of our people and many other Native American tribes is that the red haired giants, and he believes like I believe that these were the remnants of the Nephilim, these red-haired, six-fingered, cannibalistic giants would come in with these long lances. And these lances, they would run through three of the tribe's braves at a time.
Wow.
And we took the lance and stood next to each other, and that lance would pass through three men without any problem at all.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. So, you know, we're still doing testing on that. See, this is what I mean. It's like, you know, we're actually out in the field looking at evidence, combing through private museums, private libraries, people who have artifacts from their grandfather or their great grandfather. Some of the stuff I've seen has just been absolutely astounding.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why we included in the book Armor Trail 2. That's why we've got a team of archaeologists who are trying to get DNA samples out of Peru, because that's going to tell us what we're looking at. And that'll shut up the skeptics immediately.
Right.
You see, the problem is with that Melba Ketchum did DNA testing with so-called Bigfoot samples, and she was just laughed and attacked to derision. And that's what we have to avoid. That's why we go in with a team of archaeologists, forensic anthropologists, DNA. I mean, the experts. I'm not an expert in any of those things.
Right.
I'm just sort of overseeing the whole operation.
Right.
But I'm not an expert. We hire the experts that we need, and we hire multiple experts. Aaron Judkins, who wrote a very interesting, we took him to Peru, and he examined the skulls, and he was not impressed. He did not feel that anything was anomalous. But I pointed out to him that even the one skull, which showed a 30% greater cranial capacity, he just kind of went, well, that's interesting, that's anomalous, but that's all he said about it. Where I've showed the same skulls and pictures to other medical professionals, and they all just sit there and go, oh my gosh, where'd you get this?
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's okay. We included, Dr. Judkins, analysis in the book, and that's fine. That's what we'll go with for right now, but that's just one reporter's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And the DNA evidence is really what we need. And at the time when Aaron had written this, he did not know about the preliminary DNA evidence from a geneticist from the late Lloyd Pye samples that had been tested. So, that's why we're on the trail, JD. That's why it's ongoing research. And so far, it seems to point to our hypothesis that these are Nephilim tribes that fled the Levant about 3,500 years ago.
Man, and you keep bringing up that Levant thing, and I have these, I've got so many, we're running out of time. Obviously, this is just a such a difficult thing, trying to get as much information out of you as I'd like to, but I'm interested right now in what ISIS is doing, because I've got some sources that say they're doing all kinds of digging and things over in the Levant area right now, and I just wonder how some of the current events kind of tie into prophecy right now. Do you want to touch on that for just a quick second?
Sure, I can. What's interesting is we are looking at the nascent beginnings of the Psalm 83 war. My colleague Bill Salas has written extensively about that. Prophecydepot.com is his website. Go check it out. And avail yourself of that incredible work that Bill has done. Israel has been gathered from the four corners of the earth and reestablished in her ancient homeland. And we know from prophecy that once she's brought back, she'll never be removed from her land. That's stated in the prophetic text, in prophetic literature.
Okay.
Israel is surrounded right now in the north by Hezbollah, who has at least about 120,000 to 150,000 rockets. Hamas just went to war with Israel several months ago,
mm-hmm.
and they shot 4,600 rockets at Israel. Both Hezbollah and Hamas in their charters call for the complete destruction of the Jewish state, period. To the east lies Iran, which has stated emphatically in many different occasions that they were going to wipe out Israel.
Yep, and they still are saying that. They were in the news saying that.
And then in Iraq, you've got ISIL, and they've got their eyes on Jerusalem. Need I say more?
No, you shouldn't have to, and I apologize. We're kind of out of time at this point. L.A., thank you so much for being here today. I cannot wait.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, that was L.A. Marzulli. Please go check out his website, lamarzulli.net. Tomorrow, as a reminder, Scott Bennett will be on the program. We'll be talking mortgage fraud.
According to a 2010 earnings report, Google earns nearly $80 million in a single day. On August 15, 2012, Google was fined $22 million by the FTC for illegally stealing your data. Google learned its lesson, right? Wrong. The very next day, in a show of arrogance, the Washington Post reported that Google employees rode tricycles around sacred Mayan ruins.
Because we know where you are. We know where you've been. We can more or less guess what you're thinking about.
Can you trust this megalomaniac with your personal information? Can you trust Google? With Microsoft's Bing, Steve Ballmer has personally ensured your privacy. He's even partnered with Facebook to keep you connected to your loved ones. Make the moral choice. Decide with Bing.
I'm Steve Ballmer, and I approve this message.